Hello, everyone, and welcome to the 25th episode of Late Night Crimecast. I'm your host, Robin Steffens, and every week on Thursday, I'm going to post a new true crime story. I will cover cases that are local, cases that got a lot of media attention, and everything in between. Before we get started, I would like to ask you, my late night listener, to leave a rating and review on this podcast. They are always helpful, and I would really appreciate it. Now let's get into today's case, which is a rather grim one. Today we're going to be discussing the disappearance and murder of Annie Lay. Annie Lay was born on July 3, 1985, in San Jose, California, to her parents Huang and Vivian Van Lay. She had one brother named Chris Lay, and growing up, they were raised by her aunt and uncle. Now, it's really unclear why they were raised by their aunt and uncle, but it appears that her family was from Vietnam, so I'm thinking that it could possibly be that they were separated for some time. But from what I gathered, she and her brother grew up in California with her aunt and uncle who also had three kids, and so, you know, it was a large, tight-knit Vietnamese-American family. Despite her unique situation growing up, she thrived in pretty much every area. In high school, she excelled at everything. She was valedictorian of her graduating class and was voted by her classmates most likely to be the next Einstein. She took great interest in science and medicine, and she knew she wanted to pursue this field after graduating. After being awarded nearly $160,000 in scholarships, she attended the University of Rochester in New York. There, she majored in cell developmental biology with a minor in medical anthropology. While she was there, she met a man named Jonathan Widowski, a student studying physics at Columbia University, with whom she would begin a relationship and fall in love with. Now, after finishing her bachelor's degree, Annie actually got into Yale as a graduate pharmacology student in 2007. So this just shows you how brilliant this girl was. She was on track to earn her doctorate in 2013, and in her time there, she was already doing amazing things. Yale reported that she was working on research with enzymes that could help with treating cancer, diabetes, and muscular dystrophy. You know, she really wanted to help others, and she was more than capable. She was a small girl at 4'11 and 90 pounds, but, you know, it was noted by her family that she had a determination and drive that was so great, you know, greater than anything. And she had a huge personality, and this all shone above her size, making it that much more horrible that this brilliant young woman that wanted to save lives would have her own cut short. While studying at Yale, Annie continued her relationship with Jonathan Widowski, and they eventually got engaged. They were due to be married on September 13, 2009. He was still living in New York, and she was still living in Connecticut, but they were going to make it work. Unfortunately, after sending out all of the invitations and just the excitement that comes along with planning, Annie would never see their wedding date. Annie was still in school, and like I said earlier, she was doing research for treating diseases. This meant that she would go to a research lab where she would work with animals such as mice to monitor the effects of the different medicines. And this all took place on campus. It was on September 8th that she would make her way to this research lab. That day, around 10 a.m., she left her apartment and took Yale Transit to the Sterling Hall of Medicine on the Yale campus. At about 10 a.m., she walked from Sterling Hall to 10 Amistad Street, where the research lab was located. She left her purse, cell phone, credit cards, and cash in her office at Sterling Hall. She had entered the research lab building just after 10 a.m. Mind you, this is all well documented on footage from the building's security cameras. There are around 70 to 75 CCTV cameras on the campus, and one caught her going into the building, none caught her going out. Now, this is not a girl that just goes missing without anyone knowing. First of all, she has a wedding quickly approaching just within the next few days. Then she also lives with about, four other people and, roommates that basically know her schedule. They know when she's supposed to be in and out, and, her going missing is not something that would easily go unnoticed. So it was just later that night, after she never returned home, which was definitely unusual for her, that one of her roommates decided to call the police and report her missing. Now, initially, police weren't thinking this was going to be something big. After getting all the details, they thought that she had possibly gotten cold feet due to her upcoming wedding and, just ran away somewhere. So they weren't really thinking this was going to be a missing persons case and definitely not a murder case. This quickly flipped around upon the discovery of her belongings in her office. You can imagine not too many people run away from, their wedding without their phone or money on them. So that was the first huge red flag. Then, of course, the police go and they check the cameras to see if they can get any idea what happened from that. And so they see the other huge red flag. Annie goes into the research lab and she never comes out. After finding that out, the police end up closing that whole entire building for investigation. The search for Annie was pretty intensive. They searched the building, of course, and they searched through the refuse at the Hartford dump where Yale's garbage is incinerated. They did pretty much everything they could in looking for clues as to Annie's whereabouts. The FBI, the New Haven Police Department, and the Connecticut State Police were all involved in the search. More than 100 investigators joined the search for the missing student. And after she was missing for over 48 hours, word had really spread of her mysterious disappearance. Students and faculty alike were increasingly worried. Yale even offered a $10,000 reward for information about her disappearance. This quickly became national news. And during this time, her fiancé flew in from New York and several family members came in from California. They were all desperate to hear some type of good news, to find some sign that Annie was okay. But that news would never come. 4 days into her disappearance, authorities would discover bloody clothing hidden above a ceiling tile inside the research lab building. At that point, they were pretty much convinced that something horrible had happened to Annie within the walls of that very research lab. So the next day, while they were still searching for more clues, the authorities started to smell something similar to that of a decomposing body, and with that, they brought in cadaver dogs. At 5 p.m. on September 13th, 2009, when Annie Lay should have been walking down the aisle at her wedding, her decomposing body was found stuffed upside down inside a wall. One of the authorities on the scene remarked that the killer had just crushed her in there. She was like mush. She was so smashed up you couldn't recognize her. Though her body was decomposing, the crime scene had given a lot of clues as to what had happened to her on the day that she went missing. The cause of her death was strangulation. Her jaw and collarbone were broken. She had also sustained bruises to the back of her head. When found, her bra was pushed up and her panties were pulled down. Semen was found on her panty liner. And luckily that semen was found, because it was not matched to another Yale student, but to a man named Raymond Clark. Prior to finding Annie's body, the authorities had already been looking into Clark. The building, being that it was a research lab, had high surveillance. Like I said earlier, it had around 70 to 75 CCTV cameras. But not only that, the entrance to the research lab and all of the rooms inside required Yale identification cards to be opened and accessed. Authorities and Yale officials already believed that it would be extremely difficult for someone without a Yale ID card to enter the basement lab where Annie's body was discovered. And this led them to focus their investigation on Yale employees and students. And even further, those that were seen to be in and out of the research lab that day. It was easy for them to zero in on a few suspects, and the semen found just further confirmed their suspicions. Clark, who was 24 at the time, was a lab technician at the research lab that Annie frequented and worked there in a custodial function. He was known to be hard on students who left the lab dirty because it made more work for him. It has even been said that he had emailed Annie once to complain about her leaving dirty mice cages behind after one of her studies. This was likely one of the many interactions he had with Annie because I guess they worked kind of in close quarters. Regardless of their interactions, justice was served swiftly. The police were able to get a DNA sample from him on September 16th, and that was the final piece of evidence they needed that resulted in his arrest on September 17th. And I just want to say that there was just so much evidence in this case that put Clark at the scene of the crime. First, text messages were exchanged between Clark and Annie arranging to meet on the day she disappeared. Clark sent a text message to her requesting a meeting to discuss the cleanliness of the cages of the research mice. And so there was actually some kind of rumors that maybe they had some kind of relationship, but authorities actually denied that there was any kind of relationship between them. I'm pretty sure this was just like maybe one of those friendly relationships. Like I said, they probably worked in close quarters. So maybe they communicated a few times, but I don't think it was a romantic relationship. But the text that was sent that day for them to meet up was about, you know, mice cages. So, I mean, I don't think anything romantic was going on there. But yeah, let's go back into more evidence that was found. Both Annie and Clark's DNA was found on a bloody sock, which came from the clothes found above the ceiling tile. There was also a green ink pen under Annie's body that contained Clark's DNA. His movements were also tracked because, like I said, they use entry cards to access rooms in the research labs. He had entered the room where Annie's body was discovered many times around the time that it's assumed that she was murdered, and they were actually able to compare how often he had entered that room on a regular day versus the day she went missing. And he went in there so many more times than he regularly would. Another student had found a box of white balls with blood spatter on it, and she had shown it to the police. And so this box was on a steel push cart in the room where it was later found that Annie was murdered. And so authorities say that Clark came into the room, moved the box of wipes so that the blood spatter couldn't be seen, and then he also returned again to scrub the floor drain. Traces of Annie's blood was found on those wipes and other places in the room, including the drain. There was also bloody surgical gloves found. So there was a ton of incriminating evidence already. But finally, there was the evidence on Clark himself. His face was scratched, and when police originally questioned him, he stated that his cat had done it to him. That clearly was later found to be untrue. He had additional scratches and wounds on his chest, arms, and back, suggesting a violent struggle. There was so much evidence against him, and even though he did not have a criminal record, it really helped the police at the crime scene gave everything away. Because, I mean, it's different, I guess, when someone is already, like, a convicted criminal or they have a history of violence, but this guy had no criminal history, so I feel like it would be harder for him to be convicted unless there was like this amount of evidence against him. So, you know, he was arrested rather quickly, and, you know, compared to other cases, the majority of other cases that I've covered, you know, this was super quick because, you know, sometimes even with this amount of evidence, suspects go unpunished. But in this case, justice was served, like I said earlier. After a pretty long and ongoing trial, Clark pled guilty to murder in exchange for a 44-year prison sentence. He was also found guilty of attempt to commit sexual assault. He is currently serving his sentence at the Cheshire Correctional Institution in Connecticut. He is scheduled for release on September 16th 2053. And I honestly don't agree with his sentencing. I think that he should honestly be in there for life. I mean, even though by the time he's released, he'll be of old age, I think that he should be locked away forever. I think that it really helped him in his case that he did express extreme remorse for his actions. That may have helped his sentencing a bit. Like, he had, you know, written something for the family to say how apologetic he was. He outwardly had shown that he was remorseful for everything that happened. But, you know, despite that remorse, authorities still, they don't know much about the attack when you really think about it. Like, why did he do it? What led to this? He never offered an explanation or motive for the murder. So, honestly, I think he deserves, you know, a lifetime of prison. That's my opinion. There honestly wasn't any reason for this tragedy to occur. Disappearance and murder is heartbreaking, and made even more so because of the fact that we will never know the reason why. Why such an intelligent and hardworking young woman was brutally murdered. But something that we as listeners and those invested in the case can take comfort in is that her murderer was actually, you know, arrested, found guilty, and will serve a very long prison sentence for what he's done. There was some justice served here, so we can take comfort in that, and also her family gets some kind of closure, even though not exactly, because they don't know why this really occurred, why their daughter, you know, sister, niece was taken away from them, but at least they know that the person who did it is put away. That's going to be all for this episode of Late Night Crime Cast. I'm going to end this right here. Next time you guys hear from me, it'll be a Murder Monday, so definitely look out for that. Thank you guys so much for listening. Bye.